More than ever before, companies and government agencies find themselves locked in risk controversies with an angry or frightened public. Dr. Peter Sandman of Rutgers University presents his formula for responding to public concern, the most perplexing problem in risk communication.
Thank you. Let me tell you a little bit more about my background. I'm a specialist in what's called risk communication. And risk communication, I think, means at least two very different things. One of the things it means, and I've been doing this for nigh on 20 years now, is figuring out how to scare people. What do you do when the flood is coming and folks won't evacuate? How do you get people to test their homes for radon, to use a seatbelt, to use a condom, to quit smoking? All issues where the experts tell us the hazard is serious and the public's response tends to be apathetic, where the job of risk communication is to shake people by their collective lapels and say, look here, this is dangerous, this could kill you, do something. That's risk communication. The other thing I do, I've been doing for only 6 or 7 years now, and that's figuring out how to calm people down again. What do you do when the experts tell you, when the evidence tells you that the hazard isn't all that serious and the public's going bananas? What do you do when anxiety about the risk is a greater threat to health than the risk itself? Okay. So we have these two very different things, both called risk communication. On the one hand, trying to alert people. On the other hand, trying to reassure people. Now, I try not to do both at the same time on the same issue. Okay. Among consultants, that counts as ethics. It doesn't take a lot to count as ethics among consultants. Okay. But I think it's very important for me to stress at the beginning that I have no independent expertise at all as to which of those two skills is called for. That is, I am not, as some of you are, a specialist in risk assessment. I don't know whether dimethyl meatloaf is going to kill people. Okay. What I do is figure out whether it's going to piss people off. Okay. And what we're going to be doing today is talking about risk, not in terms of does it kill people, but in terms of does it piss people off. Okay. And one of the important things to say about that is you look at these two kinds of risk communication, on the one hand alerting people to the risk, on the other hand reassuring them, is that they're both difficult. Now that may come as a surprise to you if you've done one for a long time. Suppose, for example, you spent a lot of time trying to reassure publics, trying to calm them down, to keep them from being overly upset about a risk. You may think, gee, wouldn't it be easy to try to alarm people? Wouldn't it be easy to work for Greenpeace? Might not pay so well, but wouldn't that be a piece of cake to go into a community and scare people? And the answer is no, it's not easy. Turns out it's terribly difficult. You can work very hard trying to get an audience upset about a risk. You can spend years and get no place. It is hard. In fact, the natural state of humankind vis-a-vis risk is apathy. Most people on most risks, most of the time, are apathetic. And it's very hard to get them upset. Okay. But as a lot of you know through personal experience, it is also hard once they're upset to get them apathetic again, to get the genie back into the bottle. So both of these two tasks, it turns out, are difficult. And in fact, that is the cardinal principle of risk communication. If you took a long list of hazards and you rank ordered them by something like expected annual mortality, how many people they kill in a good year, okay, and you take the same list of hazards and rank order them by how upsetting they are to people, how distressing they are to people, the correlation between the two rank orders is approximately 0.2. Okay. Some of you know statistics. You can square the correlation to get the percentage of variance accounted for, a glorious 4% of the variance. That is, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. Okay. But completely different in a symmetrical way. There are, as you know, risks that upset people even though they're not killing very many. There are also, as you may have neglected to notice, risks that kill lots of people without upsetting anybody. And what we need to figure out today is why that's true. Now, I'm going to focus more on the issue of why are people upset about risks even when the experts don't see any basis for that concern? Why do people exaggerate risk? I'm going to focus on that not because it's the more important problem. The more important problem, obviously, is when people are dying and not taking the risk seriously enough. I'm going to focus on the other one not because it's more important, but because it's tougher. Okay? Because institutions seem to be having, institutions in government, in industry, in other organizations, seem to be having enormous difficulty understanding how to deal with concerned publics, with overly concerned, or what looks to be overly concerned publics. So I'm going to focus on that one. The core problem we're trying to focus on is this miserable correlation, okay, this very low 0.2 correlation between the risks that upset people and the risks that injure people, that damage people, that kill people. Okay? Now, the question is why that low correlation? And that's a question that may strike some of you as a silly question, as a question with an obvious answer. The traditional answer of industry, for example, toward the question, why is the public afraid of the wrong risks, is very straightforward. The public's afraid of the wrong risks because the public's dumb. Which often translates to never went to engineering school. Okay. Raise your hand if you're an engineer. How many engineers do we have? Ah, yes, you know what I mean, okay? Never went to engineering school. It follows that people are irredeemably irrational. They will therefore be manipulated by sensational mass media and communist environmental groups. Okay, and you're smiling like, well, he got that right anyway. Okay, and if that's true, then it follows that the right way to deal with the public vis-a-vis risk is not to deal with the public vis-a-vis risk. Ignore them if you can, mislead them if you have to, if you're in extreme circumstances, lie to them, but for heaven's sake, don't level with them because they'll screw it up. Okay? And that is, I think, the traditional attitude of industry and, for that matter, of government, of experts in general, toward the public on risk controversies. Now, that attitude has changed, I think, only because it's had to. Little by little, company after company, agency after agency, have discovered that that attitude doesn't work. Okay? That when you leave people out, that when you ignore people, they get more angry, they get more frightened, they interfere more in policy, and the outcome is a kind of a policy gridlock, an outcome that's not good for public health, not good for public policy, not good for anything. So little by little, institutions have moved to a second explanation. Okay, they say, it's not that the public is irredeemably irrational. The problem is we haven't explained ourselves well enough. Okay. If only we sent our experts for media training. If only our charts were visible from the back of the room and in color instead of black and white. Okay. If only we could talk in English instead of jargon, then the problem would be solved. Okay. Now, that's a progressive change. To go from let's ignore the public to let's educate the public is real progress. Not least of its advantages is it's sending my children to college. Okay, so I don't want to knock it, but I have to tell you it's based on a false diagnosis. Okay, that is, if you have in the back of your mind the idea that there is a slideshow such that when you get 300 angry citizens in a high school gymnasium, you show them the slideshow, and they say, oh, now I get it. Okay, and they go home and watch television. No, there's no such slideshow. I would be delighted to teach you how to make that kind of slideshow if there was such a slideshow, but there isn't. Okay, so what am I saying? I'm trying to kind of sweep away the underbrush. It's not that people are stupid. It's not that people can't figure out the data. People, in fact, do figure out the data. People are extraordinarily good at figuring out probabilistic data when they want to. They do it when they go to Las Vegas. They do it when they buy a mortgage. I would put a variable rate mortgage up against any risk assessment that's been done in the United States to date as a complex probabilistic document, and people figure them out. And it's not that you've done such a poor job of explaining yourselves. You can do a better job. Presentational skills do matter. But you haven't done that bad a job of educating the public, of explaining the risks. And we still have this miserable 0.2 correlation between whether it's going to kill people and whether it's going to upset them. So the question is, why that correlation? I'm going to try to answer that question. Now, the word we're talking about is risk. Now, I suspect most of you know what risk means to experts, to risk assessors, but if you don't, it's very straightforward. It's a multiplication of two factors, magnitude Okay, how bad is it when it happens? Times probability, how likely is it to happen? You get your best measure of magnitude, your best measure of probability, you multiply those by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. Okay, and you know you have a future in risk assessment if you can say expected annual mortality with a smile. Okay. They don't just expect it, they look forward to it. Okay. Now sometimes that calculation of magnitude times probability is based on hard data. Automobile fatalities, for example, we can go out on the highway and count them. For most risks that lead us to big controversies, though, it's not based on hard data at all. If we look at SARA Title III, we look at most of the risk controversies that dominate our society, and the data are not at all hard. And I suspect most of you know this. If we're talking about acute risk, we're looking at a branch of magic called fault tree analysis. And if we look at chronic risk, then we are trying to reason from what happens to small numbers of rodents exposed to one substance at a time in large quantities for short periods of time, and to make judgments about what might happen to large numbers of human beings exposed to small quantities of lots of substances at once over a long period of time. Okay? That is to say, we all know what part of their bodies risk assessors pull those numbers out of. Now, as a social scientist, I have to tell you that's a source of great satisfaction to me. After 20 years of working with technical people, at last I found a technical field sloppier than my own. It may not make you similarly happy, but in any case, whether the data are hard or soft, and they're usually soft in this field, what risk means to risk assessors is this multiplication of magnitude times probability. And the problem is that's not what risk means to anybody else. May not even be what risk means to risk assessors when they go home at night, but at least in the office they mean magnitude times probability, and no one else does. So let's play fast and loose with the terminology. Let's redefine terms. Let's take what the risk assessor means by risk, this multiplication of magnitude times probability, and for the next couple of hours, let's call that hazard. Then let's take what the public means by risk, all the things that people are worried about that experts ignore, and I'm going to disaggregate that. I'm going to spread those things out in a minute, but for the moment, let's look at it as one thing and call it outrage. And that leads to the only math I want to offer you today, a new definition of risk. I would suggest that properly considered, risk is hazard plus outrage. Okay. Now that plus sign upsets people sometimes, particularly technical people. So for those of you with a technical background, I have a different definition. Risk is a function of hazard and outrage. If you don't know what that means hazard plus outrage in their code. Okay. But somehow they find that much more precise. Now, this is a redefinition that makes a difference, and let me try to explain why. The way the problem is usually seen, and remember, the problem is this miserable 0.2 correlation between whether it's going to kill you and whether it's going to upset you. The way that problem is usually seen is as a problem of misperception. Okay? It's as if the experts were in direct contact with the platonic essence of risk, while the public was denied that direct contact, forced to perceive the risk and doing a crummy job. Okay, so that, you know, if you read the literature or if you listen to experts talking to each other, they're all the time saying, the public just doesn't understand, the public just doesn't get it, doesn't perceive the risk accurately. Let's get a test on that. Would you raise your hand if you have ever said that to a colleague, the public just doesn't understand, doesn't perceive the risk correctly? Lots of hands. Good, I'm talking to the right audience. Okay. Now, what I'm suggesting here is a different way of framing the problem, a much more symmetrical way of framing the problem. I'm arguing that the experts, when they talk about risk, focus on hazard and ignore outrage. They therefore systematically overestimate the risk when the hazard is high and underestimate the risk when the hazard is low because all they're doing is looking at the hazard. Now, the public, in precise parallel, focuses on outrage and ignores hazard. The public, therefore, overestimates the risk when the outrage is high and underestimates the risk when the outrage is low. What I'm arguing is that 0.2 correlation I keep talking about, far from being the result of misperception or misunderstanding, is in fact the result of a definitional dispute. I'm arguing that 0.2 is the genuine correlation between hazard and outrage, two nearly independent variables that have one interesting thing in common. They're both called risk by different groups of people. Now, as I look at your faces, some of you buy it, okay, and some of you don't. Okay. Let me tell you what some of you are thinking, particularly the engineers who raised their hands before. Some of you are thinking, okay, this is new terminology for old concepts. What Sandman is calling hazard is real risk, objective risk. What Sandman is calling outrage is subjective, social science, artsy-fartsy risk. Now, I can't keep you from thinking that, but I want to be very clear that I'm not saying that. Okay? And if, in fact, your standard of which of these two is real and which isn't, which is objective and which is subjective, is the normal standard of science, that is, replicability of measurement, we have better data on outrage than we do on hazard. Okay? For most of these risks, I can tell you to three decimal places what they do to people's opinions. You can't tell me to three decimal places what they do to people's bodies. Okay, so if we're going to get into a pissing match over which of these two is science, I am in grave danger of winning. Okay. But I'll cut you slack, and I will concede that hazard is real, and I won't dismiss dead bodies as, oh, well, that's just hazard. Okay. But I want you to concede that outrage is real, and not dismiss angry or frightened people as that's just outrage. Because the core of my message, the core of my argument, is that outrage is as real as hazard. It's as measurable as hazard. It's as manageable as hazard. It's as much a part of risk as hazard. And it's as much a part of your job as hazard. I'm going to argue that most of your industries and most of government agencies have done